Hi everyone, this is our first of the audio lectures, and what we're going to do is pick up from where we left off. What we did before is go through aspects of the Cold War sort of generically, looking at the early Cold War and the structure of the Cold War, all the things that seem to be consistent all throughout the Cold War, aspects that we'll come back to time and time again. So all the stuff that was consistent. That's what we've already done. Now we want to actually shift gears and look at things that were not consistent. And I don't mean inconsistent, though that may be a judgment that you could make. What we're talking about here is different strategies used by different presidents. And what you see pretty clearly is if you look on slide number one, that we went through phases. First intervention, then engagement, then confrontation. What this audio lecture is going to do is go through the differences in those strategies historically, going from the 1950s all the way up through the 1980s, basically Truman and Eisenhower, all the way up through Reagan, and we'll get an idea how different presidents fought the Cold War in different ways, and also how presidents tried one strategy. When that didn't work, the next set of presidents tried a different strategy. So intervention and the failures of intervention led to an engagement strategy, and the perceived failures of that engagement strategy led to a new strategy of confrontation. And that's essentially the story. It fits Sestanovich's book in that he looks at repeating patterns of maximalist presidents who intervene and intervene heavily, then retrenchment presidents who back off a little bit, and that's followed by another maximalist president who intervenes again. And essentially, that's the story we're going to be telling here. First, some basic stuff. What I'll do with this is you should be listening to this audio lecture, and you should be looking at the PowerPoint slides at the same time, because what I'll do is refer to the PowerPoint slides. If you look at the right-hand corner of the PowerPoint slides, you'll see a number, and I'll use that number as the identifier for what slide I'm talking about. So I'll say, and now we'll move from slide number one to slide number two, and then you'll know to go to the next slide, you'll know that we're moving to the next thing. Each one of these lectures, I'm going to try to shoot for an hour or so, and there should be four of them, so that'll be about 4 hours, and that's roughly right, given two classes in a session that has 3 to 5:40 classes. Roughly about 2 hours of each class is actually me lecturing. There may be a 20-minute break. There may be 10 to 15 minutes worth of questions, so an hour is probably right. I'll shoot for that. Either way, you'll occasionally hear me pausing, because if I'm talking straight for an hour, I will dehydrate completely, so occasionally I will stop and pause and take a sip of my coffee, which I'm doing now. So, hold on. All right, let's jump to slide number two. We're talking about strategies, and strategies for fighting the Cold War. What never changed, though, was essentially two goals. The United States was always trying to contain the Soviet Union. It always was. All presidents, even presidents who were accused of not trying to contain the Soviet Union, they really were trying to contain the Soviet Union. And criticisms of them, or really partisan criticisms, you can argue that their containment strategies failed, but you can't really argue that they stopped trying to contain the Soviet Union, because that was always a goal. The second goal related to that is avoiding nuclear war. And that's the dilemma there. If you look on the slide, the basic dilemma is that you wanted to contain the Soviet Union, but you didn't want to have a nuclear war. And that dilemma was all throughout the Cold War, and that essentially was the essence of deterrence itself, that policy of, well, that's how you do it. You contain the Soviets, and you prevent nuclear war using deterrence. But aside from deterrence, there are all these other strategies that we're going to talk about. So these are the things that never changed, that containment and the goal of avoiding a nuclear war. Now let's move on to slide three. What did change, and this is a summary, and I've essentially already given this summary, but this is maybe a little bit more specific. And this is one of those slides where I'd say you don't need to write everything down when I talk about slide three, because this is just an outline of everything that we're going to do for the next 4 hours of lecture here. The first strategy is intervention, and that's highlighted by the wars in Korea and Vietnam, and that's a containment by direct political military involvement or intervention. And you'll see what I mean when we get to that. Following the perceived failures of Korea and Vietnam, though you could argue that Korea was a success and Vietnam was a failure, most strategists think of it that way. And one way of thinking about it is that if you look on a map, you will see South Korea, which was the country the United States was defending. And if you look on a map, you will not see South Vietnam, which was the country we were trying to defend. So that gives you a sort of a broad look at what you could consider to be success or failure. Now, after Vietnam, the United States moved to engagement, and the strategy, specific strategy for that through the Nixon, Ford, and Carter administrations, though it started to a certain extent under Kennedy and Johnson. We'll get to that a little bit. That's containment by management of Soviet behavior, essentially trying to get the Soviets to play by the rules. And we'll talk about the strategies in particular that Nixon used to try to get the Soviets to play by the rules. When it was felt that détente, that engagement, had failed, that's when the Reagan administration moved to a more confrontational strategy. It wasn't an intervention strategy, nothing like Korea or Vietnam, but it was a containment based on challenging the Soviets, and in particular challenging gains that communism made during the 1970s. Now again, this is big picture stuff. We're going to get to the details of all this, as you'll see when we go and look at this chronologically, all the way from Truman up to Reagan. Now let's move to slide 4. Basically, here's a dynamic, another way of saying what we said in the previous slide. When you look at the strategies, our intervention was the logic of containment in action, right? We're trying to prevent the spread of Soviet communism. Well, we use political military means, and sometimes that means actual United States military forces, right? So we did that. And then the question is, was engagement the result of the failures of intervention? Right? Did we try a different strategy because our involvement, our interventions failed? In particular, Vietnam was seen as a disaster in U.S. foreign policy, the first war that the United States lost. So maybe we try a different strategy. And then the third thing there, the confrontation strategy of Reagan, and Reagan would have said this specifically, we're doing this strategy because détente, or engagement, had failed. And there are real questions about whether it did fail or not, but it was perceived to fail. We'll talk about some of those issues when we get to the Carter administration. So again, that's slide 4. And let's see, what do we want to talk about now? We want to get moving to slide 5. We're going to talk about the first strategy, intervention. So the question or dilemma is, how do you fight communism and avoid nuclear war? Well, that's the question on slide 5. Slide 6 is the first solution that the United States came up with. And I apologize for this, but the number in slide 6 is in the far right corner of the map. You can see sort of the faint outline of slide 6. Slide 6 is the one that says Korean War 1950-1953. All right, so let's talk about the Korean War a little bit. Earlier in the previous lecture, we talked about a bipolar world. We talked about several countries in which the United States and the Soviet Union directly confronted each other in the aftermath of World War II, and the decision was made to split those countries. You had East Germany and West Germany, and you had East Berlin and West Berlin, and you had North Vietnam and South Vietnam. Well, you also had South Korea and North Korea. And without getting too deeply into this, because the readings are pretty good on this, the basics are this. South Korea was an anti-communist state. It wasn't a democratic state yet, but it was definitely an anti-communist state. North Korea was a communist state, a strong ally of the Soviet Union, and to a certain extent an ally of China. And the confrontation, the Korean War, actually made the Chinese and North Korean alliance much, much stronger itself. But the basic outline of the war is, in June of 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea. And if you look on this map, and I wouldn't ask you to know this map, but if you look on this map, you'll see the black lines. That's the original North Korean invasion, and that's charting the war from June through September 1950. And you can see just how deeply that North Korean strike came down to the point where in September of 1950, you see this little green outline. The major city there is Pusan. At times that was referred to as the Pusan perimeter. That was the extent of what was left of South Korea. North Korea had conquered everything else at that point. So here is a case where communist aggression against an anti-communist state. So the forces of the red on that big map we talked about were trying to gobble up a small blue zone and turn that red. So here was an anti-communist ally that was about to disappear. Well, interestingly enough, at the time, this was seen as not just a war about Korea, but it was also seen as potentially the beginning of World War III. If actually you go back and look at the history of this, you'll see that the United States, by 1950, had withdrawn most of its military forces from Europe. And it's after the Korean War that the United States actually started to send troops back to Europe. We sent troops to Taiwan also. Essentially, we thought this might be the beginning of World War III, that a communist ally of the Soviet Union in China would invade South Korea, and hopefully that would cause the Western states, the blue states, the states of the free world, to go and pay attention to South Korea and fight in South Korea, and then they would launch a war to conquer West Germany and France and eventually England. So it's felt that this could be a feint, not a war to just unify Korea, but the beginning of a major war that would be World War III. Well, here the problem was, how does the United States defend South Korea without winding up engulfed in a nuclear war? Well, the response, and it was kind of an ad hoc response at the time, was something called limited war. Well, first, it wasn't that limited. Mid-September 1950, you can see a little green arrow on this map called Incheon Landing, and that was an amphibious landing of U.S. and allied forces that were sponsored by the United Nations. Turkey, Norway, most of the NATO allies were involved in that as well. And, of course, South Korean forces to land there and move up. And at the time, the point was to say, fine, North Korea invaded South Korea, we'll invade North Korea, and we'll take it over. And there was a big dilemma at the time about whether China would intervene. Douglas MacArthur, General Douglas MacArthur, the commander of all U.S. forces in the area, said to Harry Truman, don't worry, the Chinese will not intervene. I can guarantee it. We know now that actually MacArthur had very, very good intelligence that was telling him that the Chinese were going to intervene, and he did not pass that information on to Truman. He lied to the President of the United States. And the result was that Truman said, well, if the Chinese aren't going to intervene, then let's free North Korea and conquer it and eliminate that government. What happened is the Chinese intervened. 85,000 troops in the first wave, and then more and more and more. So here you had the United States fighting China directly. So the problem there was, well, what if the Soviet Union gets involved? Does that also bring Japan involved? And then, well, what do we have? We have World War III, and that goes possibly nuclear. Well, here's what happened. So the United States moved to a strategy, written there on the slide, called limited war. Limited war was a unique type of strategy because it basically had a goal of isolating this war to the Korean Peninsula, limiting it to the Korean Peninsula, basically saying, we will fight over Korea, but we're going to try to prevent this war from becoming World War III. Now, that's the same dilemma we're back to. How do you fight communism and avoid nuclear war? Well, limited war is a strategy. What we do is we fight communism in this area and only in this area. We try not to allow this to expand. Expansion possibly means World War III. World War III possibly means nuclear war. So here's what the United States did. First, limited the goals. Once the Chinese moved in, the United States abandoned the goal of eliminating North Korea and basically said, we will allow North Korea to continue to exist. There had been a goal of eliminating North Korea, taking it over, and making this a unified Korea again. The United States abandoned that goal and said, essentially, what we'll do is we'll fight around the 38th parallel. You can see the 38th parallel on the map. That was essentially where the divide between North and South Korea was going to be. So, a limited goal. Secondly, limited weapons. The United States never used nuclear weapons, decided it wasn't going to do it. The idea was, well, maybe the war would be would be over in 3 or 4 days if the United States used nuclear weapons. Because the United States had overwhelming superiority at that time, no question about it, in 1950 through 1953. The Soviets were way behind. But the United States said, no, we don't want to use nuclear weapons because you don't want to take that first shot because the Soviets will take a second shot. And maybe the United States can win the war, but millions of Europeans would die, millions of Koreans would die, millions of Chinese, millions of Japanese. The United States said, we're going to limit the weapons that we use. So the United States never used that. And so the United States fought a war from 1950 to 1953, and over 30,000 Americans died during that war. Some people said that was a mistake, that the United States should have gone ahead and just used nuclear weapons in the beginning. But the Truman administration said, we don't want to lean in the direction of World War III. So limited goals, limited weapons. Limited geography. The third thing, kind of interesting. Because what the United States did, and the Chinese and the Soviets also reciprocated with this, is we looked at it and we said, we will bomb North Korea. We will bomb Chinese forces in North Korea. But we will not bomb Chinese forces that are in China. So the idea was the Chinese forces would mass for an attack just across the border. The United States wouldn't bomb those troops until they crossed the border. The Chinese Air Force would actually run bombing raids to bomb NATO troops, to bomb the UN-sponsored troops, to bomb U.S. troops, and they would take off from air bases in China, and the United States never bombed those air bases. The idea was we didn't want this to expand. We didn't want this to become a war between the United States and China, which could become a war between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Chinese and the Soviets, for their part, because the Soviets were actually bombing troops as well. Now, it was a secret. United States and Soviet fighters were actually going after each other in dogfights up in the sky. That was kept a secret because the Truman administration didn't want Americans to know that Russians might be killing American soldiers, because Americans would then say, let's start World War III, want to do it. And of course, the Soviets kept everything a secret, so that was an issue for them. But the Chinese and the Soviets didn't bomb Japan, and the United States was running bombing raids from Japanese air bases. They never bombed Japan. We never bombed China. The idea was keep this a war over Korea, keep it in Korea, again, to prevent World War III. The last thing is talking and fighting. It was a strategy of saying that while we're fighting, we're also going to be negotiating at the same time in hopes that we can end the war. Because nobody's picking up any territory. We're just fighting around the 38th parallel. Nobody has the ability to destroy anybody else. It's a war of attrition. I mean, that's a specific kind of war in which everybody is just losing more and more people, more and more material. And the question is, at some point, someone's going to say, okay, I give up. And actually, that was 1953. You wound up with peace talks that were successful. But successful in this, to a certain extent, South Korea and North Korea, both of them still exist. North Korea and South Korea are still technically at war. The United States and North Korea are still technically at war. Around the 38th parallel, there's a truce line. You can actually see the little dotted line there. That's the demilitarized zone. And that still exists today. And there are troops lined up. It's the most militarized border in the world. So that war essentially is still there. And of course, North Korea is a major problem for the United States and for everybody in the region, something that we'll see, we'll talk about again and again, because North Korea keeps cropping up as a problem. The Bush administration and Obama administration still have problems with North Korea. The war itself was very unpopular because the most Americans didn't like a strategy of limited war. They said, well, what are we achieving? You know, what did we do? We fought for 3 years. North Korea still exists. And a lot of people felt, well, maybe we should have used nuclear weapons to just win the war. And within the United States military, there was something called the Never Again Club. And the Never Again Club was, we'll never, ever fight a ground war in Asia. That was something everybody in the United States military said, we're never going to do that. Never, ever, 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 ever. Well, as it turns out, we did that 10 years later in Vietnam. That war itself was very unpopular, and Harry Truman himself became very unpopular for this. Unpopular enough that Harry Truman could have run for re-election in 1952 and decided not to. And said, that's it, I have very little popularity at this point. This is a guy who, at the end of World War II, was the president when the United States defeated both Japan and Germany, and his approval ratings at certain points were over 80%. And by the time that he would have to decide to run for re-election in the spring of 1952, his approval ratings were about 30%, because people said, you can't end the war in Korea. Well, actually, Eisenhower, in 1952, when he's running for president, says specifically, I will go to Korea. I will end this war. And he made it kind of clear that he was ready to use nuclear weapons to end the war. Now, that may have ended the war. People think maybe that threat did end the war when North Korea looked at it and said, they're ready to use nuclear weapons. What do we do? And the Soviets said, sign the peace agreement. On the other hand, a big thing that happened in 1953 is that Stalin died. And when Stalin died, a new Soviet leadership came in. And that new Soviet leadership basically felt, we know this now, once the Cold War over, we have access to archives. We know that that new Soviet leadership came in and said, this war is costing us a whole lot of money and we're not getting anywhere. And they turned around and they said, you're wasting our money. You're wasting our time. We don't want this war to continue. And they urged North Korea to sign a peace agreement. And North Korea did. And we're still actually in that aftermath of that peace agreement. Demilitarized zone, North Korean, South Korean hostilities, and North Korea hostile to everybody on the planet. Well, the point of this is limited war was the strategy. What we do is we fight a war, but we keep that war isolated so it doesn't expand into World War III. Let's move on to slide 7, because here's another example of intervention. This is another limited war. This is a map of Vietnam after 1954. And to discuss Vietnam, you can probably go back, about couple thousand years to get into it, to really sort of give you the full fleshing out of the war. No need to do that. No, I'm going to try to avoid my tendency to start every lecture with the earth cooled. So what I'm going to do here is just give you a basic aspect of, if you look at Vietnam and you look up in the right-hand corner of that map, you'll see the word China. And if you go back a few thousand years in Vietnamese history is all about trying to stay independent of China. The first major revolt against China occurred in 40 AD, so we're not talking about something recent. So China was always the large country imposing in on Vietnam, never conquered it. Vietnam was independent, but China very clearly was saying, we're in charge of the whole area, and you will do what we want you to do. We'll be able to push you around, but if you don't let us push you around, then we'll slap you around militarily. And China had been that way for a couple thousand years. Well, the French moved in and eventually colonized Vietnam. Then, of course, in the 1940s, Japan invaded Vietnam and took over. And when Japan was defeated in World War II, the French moved back in and said, well, just make this a colony again, like it used to be. Well, from that perspective, the Vietnamese said after World War II, we fought for our independence against the Japanese. Now the French moved back in. Well, we're going to fight for our independence against the French. And you actually had a group called the Viet Minh, which was short for a very long word for Vietnamese Independence League. And that group of people, led by Ho Chi Minh, and this, some of the readings will talk about this, Ho Chi Minh, the leader of the Viet Minh, said, we're going to fight the French. And actually, in 1954, they defeated the French. So the independence movement defeated the French. Now, you might say, hooray for the independence movement. That's great. Because who's for colonialism, except maybe the French or the British at the time, the Portuguese and also other Europeans. But the point was that that Vietnamese independence movement was also a communist movement. And it allied with the Soviet Union. And actually, it initially tried to ally with the United States. And during World War II, the Viet Minh, their ancestors, actually were allied with the United States. The United States worked with them. And that group, the Vietnamese independence group, was hoping that the United States would actually support their independence. Instead, the United States said, France, you can have Vietnam back. Well, they fought the French. They defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu. That's a sort of classic statement that says, failure. And the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu. And the result of that was actually the division of Vietnam into South Vietnam and North Vietnam. Again, that classic strategy in the Cold War to go ahead and say, all right, what do we do with a country that we both claim? Well, we cut it in half. So they cut it in half. The Vietnamese Independence League, the Viet Minh, who were communists, took North Vietnam and set up a communist state. And the bottom part was an anti-communist state that the United States was trying to create and build up into an independent country. Well, that's 1954. What happened is the initial plan was that the division was going to be temporary. The country would be unified in 1956 with free and fair elections. The problem was that it looked very, very clearly like the North Vietnamese, the communists, were going to win those elections. So the United States at the time was now the essentially a mentor of South Vietnam. South Vietnam, a client state of the United States in the Cold War. And the United States turned around and said, well, what we're going to do is we're not going to reunify the country. We're not going to make it one country. We're going to make it two independent, separate countries, like North and South Korea. That same type of idea. Split right there at the 17th parallel. We got another parallel that will divide. You can see the demilitarized zone on this map, in the idea that there would be an independent, non-communist South Vietnam, and North Vietnam would be a communist state, and we'll just learn to live with each other in that way. Well, the North Vietnamese said, absolutely not. We want to unify this country. And within a few years of the declaration that there would be an independent South Vietnam, the North Vietnamese started to try to overthrow the South Vietnamese government. And it was an unusual type of war. It was not the kind of war that we might imagine in World War II, right? If you imagine World War II, you've got tanks. And tanks are moving across territory and conquering territory and then saying, okay, these are the new battle lines and this is our territory, which is growing and your territory is shrinking. Well, that's not what they did. What the North Vietnamese did is said, we're outnumbered. We can't possibly move southward with tanks and aircraft and armored personnel carriers because we don't have any of those things. So they fought what's called insurgent warfare. They fought an insurgency or guerrilla warfare. You might have heard that strategy. It's a strategy of the modern version based on things that Mao Zedong was doing in China. And the person who actually designed this strategy in Vietnam was a general called Vo Nguyen Giap. G-I-A-P was his last name. General Giap designed the strategy. And essentially what it was designed to do was to undermine the South Vietnamese government. They didn't take territory, but what they did is they attacked economic targets. So blow up a bridge, blow up a rural electricity grid, blow up something which was a storehouse for grain or any kind of other agricultural product that people were growing. They'd take months to grow it, and you'd put it all in one place, and then someone would blow it up. You'd assassinate political leaders, and particularly village leaders of various small towns or some of the major cities. And the point was to just create chaos as much as possible, to make South Vietnam ungovernable, to delegitimize the government, so that the average person would say, this government can't protect me. What do I do? How can I be loyal to this government that can't protect me? So you'd attack and then disappear into the jungle. You'd attack, then disappear into the mountains. You'd attack, then disappear out into the sea. Look at that coastline area. You just disappear out there. And the idea was to make the government eventually collapse. Now, at the same time that you did that, you actually tried to build up a shadow political structure. You move your political people in, and you try to build up essentially a shadow government, an alternative government that actually had the loyalty of the people, in which you would say, we're going to kill the South Vietnamese government representatives. We're going to destroy villages that are loyal to South Vietnam. But if you become loyal to North Vietnam, we'll protect those villages and try to get villages and towns to move their allegiance from South Vietnam to North Vietnam. Now, you had the North Vietnamese troops engaged in a lot of this, but you also had a whole lot of people in the South who had loyalty to North Vietnam. Some of them were Southerners, some of them were Northerners who were actually moving south and established essentially residents there in order to fight this war. Those Southerners who were fighting, those were the ones called the Viet Cong. And you've probably heard that term, Viet Cong, short for Vietnamese Communists. Well, the guerrilla war idea was to go ahead and fight and continue to do this until the South Vietnamese government collapses. And there's an old phrase about guerrilla warfare that says a guerrilla wins by not losing. The idea was, as long as the guerrillas continue to fight, as long as the insurgency continues, we will sap the will of the South Vietnamese government and eventually it will collapse. Now, the reason I go into this in some detail is this might sound familiar to you. It's very similar to the strategy that was used by the opponents of the democratic process in Iraq. After the United States overthrew the Iraqi government in 2003, an insurgency began where you had Shiite militias who were trying to destabilize a Sunni-based government. And Sunni and Shia are the two main parts of the Islamic religion. That division between Sunnis and Shiites is a lot like the division between Catholics and Protestant in Christianity. So you had Sunni groups and Shiite groups, and the Shiite groups were actually trying to undermine a Sunni government, and Sunni groups were trying to undermine the dominant Shiite government. So wherever there was a Sunni leadership, the Shiites were trying to undermine that. Wherever there was a Shiite leadership, Sunni groups were trying to undermine that itself. And the main government in Iraq was a Shiite-based government, and you had a Sunni insurgency trying to destroy all of that. Well, we'll get into all of that later, but the important thing is to understand just the guerrilla concept. You're not taking towns and controlling them with military force, but you're getting political allegiance to them, and you're making the country ungovernable. Now, the Soviets are backing all of this. The Soviets were bankrolling wars of national liberation. That's what they referred to them. Essentially, the regional conflict we talked about. So the Soviets are bankrolling the North Vietnamese here. And there was a supply line called the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Ho Chi Minh being the leader of the North Vietnamese, that ran through Laos and Cambodia and into South Vietnam. That was the supply line. So the United States looked at that and said, well, what do we do? Well, this is the late 1950s when this begins, but it's still going on into the early 1960s. So why does the United States care? Well, let's look at the strategic logic. At the time, in the 1950s and in the 1960s, this was the strategic logic. The United States believed in something that people referred to as the domino theory. The idea was that if one country falls to communism, other countries in the region would fall to communism. So you see on the slide 8, you'll see China falling, then Korea falling, then Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Burma, India. The idea was that at some point you have to keep one domino standing. In Vietnam, that was the domino. The Kennedy administration decided that was the domino. Actually, in a memo, Kennedy actually said, Vietnam is the place. That's where we prevent dominoes from falling. China had already fallen to communism. North Korea already existed. Laos actually fell to communism already at that point. So Vietnam was the place where the United States would hold the line, keep that domino standing. Now, that was a belief. That was a belief held by Democrats and Republicans at the time. There really were very few people who were saying, yeah, I'm not sure that's going to work because these countries are different. Interestingly enough, right at the time that the United States began to seriously, heavily intervene in Vietnam in 1965 under the Johnson administration, there was a coup in Indonesia, really complex coup, but the upshot of it was the Communist Party of Indonesia was wiped out. Now, there were massive human rights violations, some estimates of maybe 2 million people killed. Most of them had nothing to do with communism. They were simply opponents of a military regime. But the Indonesian Communist Party was destroyed at the time. And there are people in hindsight who say that was the end of the ability of communism to spread in Southeast Asia, that Indonesia was the key domino, and that domino had been stabilized, and that Vietnam actually wasn't relevant. Now, that wasn't the belief at the time, and we'll never know. That's a hindsight type of thing that if you run an alternative version of history, we could find out, but those aren't the kind of experiments the political scientists can run. At the time, though, both the Kennedy and Johnson administration and opponents Political opponents of theirs in Congress, Republicans, felt Vietnam was the place where the United States had to make a stand. If Vietnam falls, they all fall. That's the strategic logic of why the United States intervened in Vietnam. The idea was we need to contain communism and we have to stop communism in Vietnam. Now, the Kennedy administration actually is the one that ramped up U.S. involvement. Now we're moving to slide 9. See a picture of JFK, a picture of LBJ. Now, the Kennedy administration did, for several reasons. Well, first of all, the Kennedy administration increased U.S. forces there from about 600 advisors to about 16,000 advisors. The idea was that the North Vietnamese are trying to destabilize the South Vietnamese government. The United States is going to help South Vietnam fight this war. Essentially, go ahead and aid them, train them, teach them how to fight. Kennedy was also enthralled with the idea of fighting insurgent warfare. He was a big believer in counterinsurgency, the strategy that you would use to fight insurgents. And the idea there is that while the guerrillas are trying to attack things and disappear, well, you don't let them disappear, you hunt them down. And the guerrillas are trying to take small villages and make them allied to North Vietnam, get their allegiance to North Vietnam, and what you do is you politically try to fight that by getting those South Vietnamese villages to be loyal to the South Vietnamese government. So it was called for hunting down guerrillas, which means tracking them. You didn't have a front in the war like you did, imagine a World War II style front, but you were hunting down guerrillas and they would attack you and you chase them. And this was a messy kind of warfare, a very, very ugly type of warfare. But that's the kind of warfare. And Kennedy thought that that was an amazing thing and the United States needed to know how to do that. So he was very gung-ho about that. The United States military actually was not. But Kennedy said, you're going to learn how to do this because I'm the commander-in-chief and I'm going to teach you. And that's when special forces were created and you had a special warfare school created. I guess in Fort Bragg, if I'm wrong about that, you can remind me. But I think it's in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where a school for special warfare was created, where Kennedy said, we're going to learn how to do this. Now, after Kennedy is assassinated, Lyndon Johnson picks up the mantle there and very strongly believes in the domino theory and says, we're going to continue this. Now, we'll see how he actually escalated the war in a second. But let me point this out, that you'll see the top of the slide, slide 9, says containment and domestic politics. And this is a key factor in all of this, because Democrats had been accused of not being tough enough on communism. So, for instance, go back to the Korean War. Harry Truman was accused of not fighting hard enough. Harry Truman was accused of actually even being a communist by several Republicans who said if Truman really wanted South Vietnam to stay independent, he would use nuclear weapons, and he didn't really care. Go back a little bit further, there was a debate about who lost China. When the communists in China won, there were people who said, why didn't the United States intervene? Now, most people analyzing it, including the United States military, said if the United States had intervened in China, we wouldn't have stopped communism. We would have just started World War III, and China would have been communist anyway. That was a lost cause at that point. But Truman was criticized heavily for not being tough enough on communism. And so Kennedy and Johnson, the next Democratic presidents, were constantly being criticized for not being tough enough on communism. So Kennedy and Johnson both felt, well, if we lose Vietnam, we'll suffer the same fate as Truman. And Republicans were very explicit about that. They were saying, you've got to hold the line in Vietnam or else you're not tough enough. So both presidents also had a domestic political reason to say, we've got to fight there because if we don't fight there and we don't win in South Vietnam, our presidencies are over. Now, you might look at that and say, how can a president decide that his political fate, just his political fate, his ability to win re-election, requires thousands of troops to fight in a war all the way across the planet? Well, that's a really good question, and people have been asking that question for years. How much did domestic politics, how much was the Vietnam War related to two political leaders hoping to stay in office? Good question. Very good question. No one has the answer to that. But there was a strategic logic and there was a domestic political logic as well. Both of those were operative. I'm not sure that you can separate them out. Let's move to slide 10 because this really fleshes it out. Here's the basic dilemma that Kennedy and Johnson faced. You can't lose South Vietnam. Because if you lose South Vietnam, well, all the other dominoes will fall and your presidency is over. But you can't do what you need to win, because you can fight insurgent warfare, insurgency versus counterinsurgency, but you don't seem to be winning. North Vietnam isn't being defeated. North Vietnam still exists. Well, what if you tried to invade North Vietnam and conquer it and defeat it? Well, what happened in Korea? The Chinese intervened. In this case, the Soviets were the chief client of Vietnam. Do the Soviets intervene? Do you wind up with World War III? So what do? Counterinsurgency isn't working. You can't try to destroy North Vietnam because that might lead to World War III and nuclear war. The solution was go back to limited war. And what the Johnson administration did is from 1965 through 1968, it kept adding more and more troops. First to defend airfields, then to fight counterinsurgency, then to try to engage in more conventional military tactics, which didn't really work, to try to get the North Vietnamese to fight in big, what they call set piece battles, where you fight more like World War II. And the idea was, we'll do more of that. From 1965 to 1968, what the administration did is it would add 25,000 troops. And then 6 months later, it would add another 50,000 troops. And then 6 months later, it would add another 25,000. And then 6 months later, it would add another 75,000. It was this gradual introduction of more and more U.S. forces. Never a big decision to add 400,000 troops, but decisions to add 25,000, 50,000 here and there, until you got to 1968, the beginning of 1968, when the United States had over 500,000 troops there, fighting up a very large war at the time. Mostly counterinsurgency, again, but an attempt to fight some conventional battles. Well, aside from that, the limited war, the United States also used coercive diplomacy. And the idea was bombing. And it fits into limited war scenario, in which what the United States would do is we'd bomb heavily in North Vietnam, bomb them, and then actually stop bombing and say, are you willing to surrender? And North Vietnamese would say, no, you're asking us to give up parts of our country. That was their conception of this. We're trying to unify our country, and we will not give it up. They actually even said, this is like the American Civil War. When was the North going to give up the South? They said, that's exactly what this is. We are the North, and we're not giving up the South. So we would bomb a little harder and bomb farther north, moving towards the capital of North Vietnam. Geographically, if you imagine a map of North Vietnam, you can go back to... Which slide number that is? Slide number 7. If you slide back to slide number 7, imagine North Vietnam gridded off. Imagine just drawing a grid across it, and you'd bomb one part of the grid. Looks like graph paper. You'd bomb one square and then say, you're ready to give up? They say no. Then you bomb another square. Ready to give up? They say no. You bomb another square. And you do this for 3 full years. From March of 1965 to February of 1968 was something called Rolling Thunder. If you imagine Rolling Thunder, that was the metaphor that they were using. We're going to keep bombing, you know, square by square by square. That's actually what carpet bombing is. You may have heard the term used by some presidential candidates, used incorrectly, actually. But carpet bombing is actually when you simply grid off an area and say, we'll bomb everything there. And the idea was we bomb more things, we bomb harder, we escalate the bombing, and we consistently say, are you ready to surrender? And they said no. And the idea of coercive diplomacy is that we can't achieve our goal necessarily. We can't overthrow the government of North Vietnam because we don't want World War III, but what we can do is try to influence their decision. So we hurt them. And we hurt them and hurt them and hurt them and hope that enough pain, the pain caused by bombing, will cause them to turn around and say, yes, we will do what you've asked us to do. Well, the United States did that for 3 years, and North Vietnam never gave in. And this was a test of wills. The United States is bombing and saying, North Vietnam, we want you to give in, abandon your quest to unify the country. Well, at the same time, North Vietnamese were saying, we're going to hurt the South Vietnamese government so badly it collapses. All we need to do is stay alive. All we need to do is continue to maintain the ability to fight. And eventually, South Vietnam will collapse. So both militaries and political systems were fighting this test of wills. Ultimately, as we'll see, the North Vietnamese won that test of wills. If you look at slide 11, you'll see the result of that test of wills. In early 1968, late January, early February, the Vietnamese launched a major offensive. That offensive was actually a failure. It didn't conquer the ground that they hoped it would ground. It was actually more of a conventional offensive to take territory. Failed miserably. But it succeeded politically in a very, very big way within the United States. What I mean by that is that at that time, the Johnson administration was consistently saying, we're about to win. Or on the verge of winning. Everything's great. We're about to win. Just a few more months, maybe a year. We're about to win. Everything's going to be great. And then the North Vietnamese launched this massive offensive. And it undercut the argument of the Johnson administration. Meanwhile, the American people didn't realize it, but the commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam, William Westmoreland, is actually saying, President Johnson, we are about to win. What you've been saying is true. All I need is another 200,000 troops. And Johnson's eyes got wide. Another 200,000 troops to bring the total over 700,000 troops. So Johnson at the time looks at some of his aides and says, all right, let's look at this. Is it possible? Can we win this? Is it doable? And what happened is at this point, most of Johnson's administration had started to say, this war doesn't make any sense. We are not going to win. It's not going to be possible to win because essentially there's a home field advantage in that the North Vietnamese are willing to fight and fight and fight because it's their country they're fighting for. And the United States is looking at it and saying, well, this is halfway across the world. What's going on? The American people were divided. Protest marchers in the streets saying the United States should withdraw from the war. Actually, the majority of Americans said we should just win the war, and some of them said we should just use nuclear weapons, not realizing that could possibly lead to World War III. But Johnson's torn, and his advisors say, Mr. President, we can't win this. It's not going to happen. And the result is Johnson, in March of 1968, goes on national television and says, I'm ending the bombing. I'm not sending any more troops to Vietnam. I am going to offer the North Vietnamese peace talks that will begin right now. And I am not running for president in 1968. He could have run for president in 1968, and he said, I will not do it. So incredibly amazing surprise announcements in a nationally televised address. And if you click on that goodbye, I think you will get to the audio file of that. And the result actually of all that is that Richard Nixon wins the presidency in 1968. Well, Nixon's policies on this, which we'll go briefly, because we're about almost finished with this part of the lecture, Nixon's strategy is the United States is going to withdraw troops. The process of withdrawing the U.S. troops was called Vietnamization, and Vietnamization is exactly what it sounds like it is. It's U.S. forces leave and are replaced by South Vietnamese forces. So they take over the job to Vietnamize the war. That's the whole idea there. Now, at the same time, to allow the United States troops to withdraw, Nixon actually increased the bombing. Some of the largest sustained bombing in history. in world history was going on at that particular time. Only surpassed eventually with the United States' two wars in Iraq, but incredible amounts of bombing. And something there that's a factor that's relevant here is that the United States actually dropped more bombs on Vietnam during the Vietnam War than it dropped on Japan and Germany during World War II. That tells you something. That's one of the reasons why Johnson's advisors said, this isn't going to work, because we've already dropped more bombs on Vietnam than we did on Germany and Japan during World War II. How can we possibly think that a little bit more effort is going to win the war? Well, Nixon came in and escalated the bombing while U.S. forces were actually withdrawing. At the same time, Nixon withdrew those forces slowly over the four years of his first term in office. This wasn't something in which the war ended in 1969. The peace talks continued in 1969 and resulted in a signing of an agreement late 1972, early 1973 is when the agreement was finally resolved, and officially in January of 1973, the United States withdrew all its forces by that time, just in time for Richard Nixon to be reelected in November of 1972. Most U.S. forces were out by that point, and Nixon himself was looked upon as a hero for ending the war, and his right-hand man, Henry Kissinger, something we'll get to a little bit later, wins a Nobel Peace Prize for ending the Vietnam War. So the United States negotiated while increasing the bombing and withdrawing U.S. forces. Also actually invaded Cambodia as well, and Laos, as a part of the escalation of the war. And the United States withdrew from Vietnam. Now, here's a couple quick things which aren't actually on a slide. Something that becomes a legacy related to Vietnam. After this, there were a lot of debates. And the debates continue today, particularly after U.S. intervention in Iraq in 2003. We brought those same debates back up. But Vietnam was the United States' longest war, and the first war the United States lost. So that led a lot of people to ask some basic questions. Are there limits to what the United States force can do? And actually, I should create a slide for this. Hold on one second. Okay, I paused there for a second because I made a slide. Slide 12, which says Legacy of Vietnam. These are the kinds of things that were debated, and you'll see they're very, very similar to the debate that's going on after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. The question of the limits of intervention. The limits of U.S. power and force. The United States, at the time, was the most powerful country in the world. No question about it. But are there limits to that? Can the United States go ahead and remake countries? Can it accomplish every objective with force? Or maybe there are limits to that. And that was one of the real questions that came out after that, is that we had such confidence in our ability to use force to accomplish almost any objective. And maybe we need to think about that. Think about the objective and say, what can force actually accomplish? And it can accomplish quite a bit, but maybe not what we were trying to accomplish in Vietnam. For instance, you'll see difficulties of nation building. Now, wisdom of intervention as well. How often did the United States go ahead and look at its basic assumptions, the domino theory? Does it make sense that if one country becomes communist, all the other countries around it fall? It's a good question. Well, that was not an assumption that people thought about at the time. The difficulties of nation building, a third thing. The United States is using military force and trying to transport essentially U.S.-style structures to South Vietnam. Is that possible? And not necessarily, this is not necessarily a suggestion that South Vietnam couldn't accept democracy or couldn't accept the style of government, because as we've seen, countries in East Asia have become democratic, and that's not a transportation of Western ideas into East Asia, because if you go back and you look at Asian political philosophies, writings going back a couple thousand years, you'll see the roots of democracy in East Asia, just like the roots of democracy in the Western part of the world. So democracy is not something that was created by the West. We like to think that because we're the West, but ideas like freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to choose your rulers, that's something that you see the roots of in all political philosophies in the entire planet. So it's not transplanting Western ideas, but the question is, the United States is trying to use force to create a political system at a particular time in history. We're trying to create it almost out of nothing. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. The United States democracy, European democracy, Japanese democracy, South Korean democracy, they evolved over time. The question about how you can impose it from the outside, good question. Even if you look at Japan, for instance, people think the United States imposed democracy on Japan at the end of World War II, but you can see the roots of democracy in Japan going back to the late 19th century. And the militarism of Japan that led to World War II is sort of an interruption in the middle of a democratic process. Difficulties of nation building, and also nationalism. The United States was fighting against nationalism. However much the North Vietnamese were communists, they were also Vietnamese. They also were seen as the nationalist heroes who had defeated the French. They had pushed colonialism out. And when the United States walks in, the United States is a foreigner. The United States had been an ally of the French. We're seen almost as trying to reimpose colonialism. So we're fighting against nationalistic forces. Is that possible? Good question. So that's part of the legacy of Vietnam. Now, what we're going to do is actually stop now and move on to some of the other legacies of Vietnam, which will begin the next lecture. So we're ending with slide 12, and we'll begin the next presentation with slide 13.